Welcome to this week's episode of The Art of Authenticity. I'm Laura Coe, your host, and thank you for tuning in. Today we have Andrew Taggart joining us. Andrew is someone who I found through an article. He teaches executives and leaders around the world. He was an article about Silicon Valley, bringing philosophy to business leaders and entrepreneurs. He is what he calls a practical philosopher and an entrepreneur. He teaches individuals and organizations how to inquire into the things that matter most. So how do you take these philosophical ideas, bring them into entrepreneurship, business executives, artists, and help them think about how these things answer the fundamental questions of how to live life, how to find that deeper sense of fulfillment or purpose. He has cultivated a very unique approach, which we go into in this episode. His PhD in philosophy gives him all sorts of different, you know, philosophical schools of thought to bring to the table. But most of all, he's just really interested in helping people live the greatest life that they can. And whatever that means, right? That is the question of questions. What is a good life? How do you cultivate that? What does it mean to have a life filled with inquiry? What does that mean for each and every person? Check it out. I hope you liked today's episode. And as always, thank you for tuning in. Welcome to this week's episode of The Art of Authenticity. I'm Laura Coe, and today we have Andrew Taggart joining us. Hey, Andrew.
Hello there.
Thank you for coming on the show. This has been a fun series of conversations leading up to a recording. For those of you out there that haven't checked out Andrew's work yet, he's got this very unique life where he is a practical philosopher. And I found Andrew through Quartz, which is a newsletter that I read every week. If you guys haven't checked it out, it's a great aggregator of information in the news. And Andrew was featured in there. So Andrew, if you could share with the audience first, PhD in philosophy, how you move from what is usually this academic route over to what you call a practical philosopher, and maybe explain a little bit about what that is.
Sure. Actually, I finished a PhD in philosophy and literature. So in some respects, many of your viewers, I suppose, will feel much the way that I did when they went through institutionalized education. And that was that we didn't quite fit into one thing or another along the way, but we may have kept going along the way. And so I began in literature, then in literary theory, and then in continental philosophy, and then in analytic philosophy. And I began to realize that I wasn't really well suited for any of these things exactly. So by the time I finished my PhD, I had what would be considered an interdisciplinary degree that ranged from questions of the good life in the modern world. And I felt as though, in a way, I had written a PhD that was my ticket out of the academy. So...
why did you feel that way?
I felt that way because it was a long odyssey through my academic training to get to a point at which I was writing about things that really mattered to me. And I was writing about them from a point of view that was much more encompassing and perhaps even generalist at a time when, at least in the humanities, it's become very specialized. Mm-hmm. So and I'll share this with you, viewers. I remember when I sat down finally after all those years and had my dissertation defense. And it struck me almost immediately and really quite sorrowfully that no one there had probably read what I'd written. This is not that uncommon, frankly. And I had asked all these very large questions about what the good life was today, what the shape of the modern world was today, and how it was possible to lead a good life. And I ranged across a number of disciplines, from literature to political theory to metaphysics to epistemology to education. And it struck me that everyone was asking questions about how X, whatever X was in that dissertation of mine, fit with the kind of research they'd been doing. Mm. And that went on for a number of hours. And I thought, for the first time in a while, that I cried. And I thought, oh, hang on a second. What just happened there? Oh, right. It was, I'm not suggesting this is always the case, the academic life, but that was definitely a farce. I'd been led to believe that the academic life was about the disinterested, caring consideration of ideas and about why ideas matter. And it struck me that that no doubt was once true, but at least it's not true for me. And so what I wanted to do then was to take the questions I was asking and, so to say, liberate them, bring them out of a particular institution and into the public world.
Yeah. No, it's funny. I mean, I went through the institution of philosophy years before you did, but I had the exact same experience. I didn't make it through the PhD process because I was so disheartened. I mean, I congratulate you.
I don't know. I don't know who's the winner, who's the loser here, frankly.
I
was probably stubborn, neither was wise. So we'll figure out who that was.
I mean, my hat goes off to you that you kept through it. So I guess we both, you know, we'll come to this from a different lens. But I felt like it was supposed to be about the ideas and instead it was ego. And I had this moment where I'm like, okay, I feel like I'm in a room with a Buddhist and a Christian, like yelling at each other. And you know, that there's these schools of thought and you have to believe in one or the other and you have to argue. And it wasn't about the ideas, but it just felt about their ego. And so when you say you were in there and when you're talking about your work, they kept talking about their own work and their own ideas. Is that what you meant by that comment or it was?
It was twofold. I think what you just said was on point. And the other thing to say is that time was, when we think about a liberal arts education proper, we think about asking some of the vital questions about human existence, about why we're here, what this is about, how shall we live, what is a good political society. And I'm not suggesting these are perennial questions. They're historically variable, and so they will be modified to some degree. But it didn't feel as if, in addition to what you said there about infighting and schools of thought, we were really getting at the heart of things, the heart of the matter. Paradoxically, we just knew we were skirting about things that seemed to have lack the depth and relevance. I was obviously, in some respects, as we'll probably get to, a little bit or quite pre-philosophical, because I wasn't really living a very wise life. I was rather foolish to believe that philosophy was the sort of thing that still occurred within a particular modern institution. And so I think that led me to believe that philosophy is actually something that goes well beyond a particular institution in which we think we find it.
Yes. And by that you mean, you know, bringing it out into the world, and that so many people think of philosophy and they think, you know, when a tree falls in the forest, does it make a sound? Like that there's these obscure ideas that have no relevance or value. And if I'm hearing you correctly, right, that you wanted to bring this stuff out and into the world where it has value, it has a bigger impact, and that it really speaks to our real lives.
I agree with you. And as we talked about in our conversation leading up to this podcast, I told you that one of the persons who was very inspiring for me was the late philosopher Pierre Hadot. And he was a French philosopher who died in 2010. And one of the things that really spoke to me about his writings is that he began to draw this beautiful picture of what philosophy used to be about. And the simple idea is that philosophy used to be about leading a certain way of life. And so one of the books we have in English translations is entitled Philosophy as a Way of Life. And I think that preposition as is very important here. So the idea is that it wasn't just a set of theoretical discourses about certain objects or certain questions. It was, much like religion, a way of living a life in accordance with the pursuit of basic matters of human existence. And I think what he's saying there is still very applicable today.
Yeah.
Sometimes people say that it's only the case that certain sort of people are philosophers, and I beg to differ. I actually think that philosophy is in principle an activity that is available to all of us, and yet sadly has only been accessed by few of us. There's a huge discrepancy between that availability. All of us could philosophize. All of us could ask these questions and consider them and mull them over and make some sense of them, but few of us, historically speaking, ever do. And so that's what I'm quite committed to.
And I think in large part, people aren't asking these questions and into it because I'm not sure most people even are totally clear what philosophy is.
So yeah.
Would you do me a favor and quickly, if you were to say, what are these questions? How would you describe it in basic terms?
Oh, that's a great question and an impossible one. We both know. So there's a joke here that I think that we might as well tell, and that is that people definitely know people definitely know philosophy when they see it, but when they try to pin it down and define it, they get in all sorts of troubles. But let me be a fool and try anyway.
And I understand. I don't mean that it's at its core, but like your website right off the bat, do you want to lead the most excellent human life, right? Like that's a philosophical question. What does it mean to live an excellent life?
Right. So I would say that philosophy, here's one very partial attempt at a definition. Philosophy is an ongoing activity whose point and purpose is to deepen our understanding of the most basic matters of existence in general and of human existence in particular.
That's awesome. And deepen, right? Because you can't quite get there, but it's about the process, not the answer.
I think it's about, right, I wouldn't say that there's a final answer. This is why that was obviously perhaps an attempt to translate one of the points that Socrates makes in the Apology, the one that your listeners will be familiar with, and that is that the unexamined life is not worth leading. And I don't think any of us here would say that's a true statement, but if we soften it a bit, we could say that the examined life seems to be certainly a life that's very much worth leading and enhances the life that we're leading in virtue of that ongoing examination. So philosophy very much promises us that if we continue to examine matters that are just beneath the surface or just above our ordinary awareness, but just around the corner, that the idea is that our life become much more fulfilling as a consequence.
All right. So hats off. That was, an awesome answer. I hope everybody listening appreciated, because that is a tough one. And since I went to college and was asked, you know, what I majored in, I'd say philosophy, and people would laugh. And what is that? What's the point of it? You know, these questions, they enhance your life. They bring more meaning. They can help get you unstuck, help you see things differently, change perspective, right? And all of that, I think, leads to an interesting and hopefully even more effective life, if depending on how you define that. And so you've taken this is what I find fascinating, because I'm a coach, but you've changed this concept into a practical philosopher to sort of stick with the philosophy side of things more intensely. And I'm almost tempted to steal this from you and see if I can start doing it too. But tell me a little bit about
First of all, there's got to be some kind of joke here about a rabbi in a room, and the joke would be something to do with the fact that you can't steal it because it's a gift. Oh,
thanks.
So you're welcome to.
And I knew you wouldn't see it that way. But no, when I'm coaching, a client once said to me, the best thing about working with Laura is that, you know, could be thinking about Krishnamurti or Plato, but you don't even have to have read the book, nor does she even tell you sometimes. So this stuff is in the back of my mind. It's how I help push people through the things that are challenging to them. But tell me about being a practical philosopher. What is it? What is a coaching session? What's that experience like for somebody?
Well, I would say that there are two different modes that I go into. One would be called practical philosophy, I suppose. The other would be called philosophical artistry. So let me begin with practical philosophy first. If someone ordinarily thinks something fairly mysterious about his or her life. So I think that Hamlet's line from Shakespeare's Hamlet is a very good one. So something is out of joint. It feels as though something is a bit off or mysterious, something that he or she can't put his or her finger on. So there's the start point is a kind of sense of mystery or sense of wonderment about things, or a deep puzzlement, as we might have learned in academic philosophy in school. Something that's just very, very strange. Jim Morrison's good here. People are strange when you're strange. You get that kind of sense that there's something really quite strange.
Yeah.
So there's a starting point. It's something that's almost hard to put into words. Someone comes, and then what we try to do is to provide the conditions that they're not used to. So it's a very defamiliarized set. I can use that dramatic metaphor. That person is living somewhere else. So it could be in Silicon Valley or on Wall Street or in Iran or Scandinavia or Central America or whatever. And we've often meditated beforehand, or at least quieted our minds for a bit. The person has the computer or electronic device off to the side, as I have now, so that he or she can't actually see it. It's not really within view. I like to sit on the ground. Suggest the other person does so as well. It's kind of an embodiment of humility, even of groundedness. And then some people like to look out the window in a certain way. Some would like to actually look up at the ceiling. Ordinarily, the space is very clean, so there aren't the ordinary distractions that our senses would pick up on. And then it's a strange combination of durational art. I'll try to say what I mean by all these things. Durational art, kind of Zen koan, and Socratic dialogue. So let me try to say something about each of those three elements that make up a philosophical conversation.
Okay.
Yeah. So the first element is durational art. This means that there's something actually that happens when you take yourself off the clock. So the clock time falls away and you're just paying attention to the question. You don't know how long the conversation will last, nor do I. And you don't know when it will end, and nor do I. So there's a passing into a different kind of space-time that occurs. And there's a sense of courage that one must invoke in order to be in that situation. So that's the first element. The second one is...
So can I ask a quick question? So do you literally mean the session will go as long as it just naturally, organically makes sense? There's no actual time element to it?
Yes. Now, there is a reply, which is we can kind of get into some different theories here. But ordinarily, human beings, particularly those who are untrained, can't often, we'll get into the third element, the Socratic one, can't often hold a line of inquiry, let's say, for 5 hours straight.
Right.
So the limits end up being the limits of our mental capacities, and they end up being kind of aesthetic limits. There usually is an arc, a particular kind of beautiful shape to a conversation. So they will ordinarily end after an hour and a half to 2.5 hours.
That's amazing. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Because for anybody who hasn't done coaching, it's typically exactly 45 minutes or an hour, and it starts and stops, and everybody holds that time frame near and dear to their heart. So it's one of my biggest pet peeves. If you've ever been coached by somebody who's very regimented on time, you could be mid-sentence and they're like, well, so we'll talk next week.
Right. And that's you're starting to get around to the strange. There are a few reasons why this is so. There are many reasons why this is so. We have from Plato's Phaedo, the famous claim, it's from Cicero actually, but to philosophize is to learn how to die. And we can translate that a little bit to say that to do philosophy is to die to the ordinary sense of time and space. Right, ordinary sense of our embodied experience. So we're trying, as we do in meditation, to enter into a different kind of space and time.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me the kinds of hangups we have in modernity, at least some of them, are owing to a certain sense of clock time. Mm-hmm. So far be it for me, therefore, to try to perpetuate that kind of suffering as we go through this. That's at least one reason. And I also might add that the mind relaxes in a certain way and starts to pay attention to the long present when one knows that someone is going to ask me a question, and that is all there is for the time that we're for our existence here. There's just this question. There's this dilated, expanded present, and here we are. So there's a beautiful form of care there.
Mm-hmm.
I think that I like to underscore this. So the second element, the Zen Buddhist one, really has to do with a sense of surprise. I think that Zen Buddhists are very good at, particularly in what's called the Mondo or Koan tradition, of trying to evoke surprise. So in the course of a philosophical conversation, a lot of it will actually be very systematic, very methodical, very much flowing according to logic reasoning. However, there are some delicious moments in which a question will come out of the blue. And it doesn't logically follow from the ones before. You might pay attention to the fact that your breathing has changed, or the particular way that you said something, or something that I recall from 3 times ago that we spoke, or whatever. And when that happens, it's a marvelous thing to see what occurs to the person. He or she stops, stunned perhaps a little bit, and is invited to think. And thinking occurs at a different kind of way. In that moment, it's not rehearsed anymore. The staid answers, the ones that he or she was familiar with, have fallen away. And there's a freshness and an openness to life that moment and thereafter. And then the third element is the Socratic one, the one that your viewers will probably be familiar with, at least to some degree. And that is that the conversations flow according to philosophical inquiries that are underwritten by the questions I pose and the answers that my conversation partner supplies. So it's a very parsimonious format, actually. Very, very minimalist because I'm not availing myself of various kinds of speech, mostly of the question, a very tightly formulated question to evoke a tightly formulated answer. So there's, yeah.
Very interesting. And how did you put this together? Was it something you worked on for a long time, or is it something that came out of practice?
I would say both. Those are both beautiful questions.
Interesting. And so I found you because of this Quartz article that you got a lot of attention for, where where Silicon Valley executives are hiring philosophers to teach them to question everything.
Obviously, what I describe sounds just like that, I think.
I mean, this deeply intellectual, complicated, honest, vulnerable, real experience being something that Silicon Valley executives are interested in, it feels a little shocking. Are your clients often, do they surprise you that they're from these walks of life that one wouldn't typically think of when you think of people who are interested in this pursuit?
I think that there are a few things that come to mind. To begin with, some people have thought, oh, this is another case of, people have thought since that article appeared, oh, this is another case of philosophers becoming sophists. Right, that they are in the service of power and influence in this day and age. Your viewers may wish to know that the sophists were, in some respects, in competition with philosophers in ancient Greece. And the sophists were seen to be the ones who got paid in order to teach. They're being paid to teach people how to grab power in ancient Greece. They were paid to learn virtues. They were paid to speak well and so forth.
This was, for anybody who hasn't read the early Plato, this was a big topic Socrates was passionate about, and this was a big subject in Athens, looked very much down upon by the philosophers. that being paid to do this was a terrible idea, according to Socrates.
Yeah. Yeah. And for what it's worth, I happen to think that there's something right there. We'd have to talk some other time about the relationship between philosophy and philosophers and money. I think it's a fascinating subject. I do actually work in an alternative economic model, a gift economy. So technically, I don't get paid, which allows me to continue this Socratic tradition. Now, as for your question about the relationship between philosophers and entrepreneurs, well, what I've discovered over the years are a few things. To begin with, entrepreneurs are actually, or can be, quite open-minded. They also have a set of moral virtues, not the least courage, that I think is vital for philosophizing. And many of them have, at least up to a point, a fairly capacious imagination. You can begin to see some elective affinities between entrepreneurship, thinking about things in some fairly unconventional or contrarian ways, a willingness to stake yourself, even though it goes against the grain, a capacity to imagine what could be otherwise than what we presently think is the case. You can begin to start to scratch it a bit more and see that there actually is some very important elective affinities between entrepreneurship and philosophy. You can think of Socrates or Diogenes the Cynic or the Stoics or others who would, at least so far, endorse what I've said.
Yes.
However, there is a however here coming. And the however is that I think Silicon Valley tends to be, as I pointed out in that article, committed to some assumptions that may not withstand good rational scrutiny. So I think one is the idea that a good life is numerically identical with a successful life. Mm-hmm. And I'm not persuaded that that's necessarily so. At least it needs to be investigated. So a number of the people I speak with who are at Google or Twitter or whatever else are people who have begun to wonder whether that's so. They've begun to wonder, hang on, I live all my life in terms of success and ambition and the like. Why is it the case that even though I've been so extraordinarily successful, there's something missing in my life, and I don't know what that is.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, that was my experience, and I interview person after person who comes on the show because we have confused the idea of success, financial success, pleasures, with fulfillment. Yeah. What have you found to be underlying that sense that there's something missing?
I think that's going to depend on each case with regard to the person at hand. But generally what philosophy has tended to say, at least Western philosophy, is that worldly success, status, these are the things that we can say over and over again have come up at different cultural moments. So worldly success, status, hedonic pleasure, exceptional wealth, all these candidates for the good life ultimately don't provide what would be a kind of happiness, a deeper sense of happiness. Yeah. And so that's at least a starting point. Then I think we would need to get into some more particular considerations with regard to the person at Twitter or the person at Google or the COO or the tech CEO or whatever, how their lives would need to be fine-tuned in order to determine what actually would count as what is greater in excess of that. I guess I can say that for me, and this is going to sound a little bit radical perhaps for the show, I think that if I can put this in quotes for a moment, God is the answer. By that I mean that there are levels of reality that are more important than our ordinary sense of, let's say, work and love or work and pleasure. I'm not suggesting these aren't important at all. I'm just suggesting that if you've had any non-ordinary experiences or have some kind of practice, you might begin to have the idea that there's a greater sense of reality. They're all metaphors here. There are greater levels of reality than what the wonderful Canadian philosopher Charles Taylor calls the immanent frame or a secular frame.
Yes. And I mean, this is, you know, been talked about in so many philosophical works, spiritual works, right? That success, status, that pleasure points, trying to keep away from pain points. Mm-hmm. Actually, all of this leads to suffering when you mm-hmm. confuse this with the interest of being happy. And that happiness, though, like, what is it? How do we find it? If you're speaking of it in terms of pleasure, success, fame, awards, money, you will find that you will have those things, but you will not find a greater, deeper sense of happiness. But leaving this question open of then what does create that happiness? And this is where it gets tough, because this starts to talk about this question of what is the purpose of life, the meaning of life, and is it unique to each of us? Is it a little different? Does one person have a calling in one direction, another person another? Is it about living based on values and character at a certain level, right? That brings that sense of purpose. And, you know, this is the one where it's hard to tease out exactly what the answer is. It's a little easier to answer what it's not. Would you say that that's fair?
I would say that's fair. And I think that there's a political philosopher, the late Isaiah Berlin, who nicely framed the question for us. He was deeply critical of communism and of a particular form of Christianity anyway. And he calls this monism, the view according to which there's one final answer to life or one final way to live. And he argues on behalf of pluralism, which most of us would be familiar with, the view according to which there are many final aims or ends in life, many, many ways of life that are worth leading in modernity. I think there's a wrinkle, though, and that's more or less where he left it. And the wrinkle is that if you grant pluralism its due, well, how do you begin to figure out, whether it's individually or in your community, what sort of life is best for you? And I think there that I try to steer course in the way of my thinking between the monism and the strict pluralism, trying to discern whether there are any answers that, let's say, relatively wise people have given over the course of time. If those answers keep kind of shaking out, then maybe they'd be ones that we could subscribe to. For example, if someone is very politically engaged, then you might say that person's telos or final aim in life could be the pursuit and actualization of justice or a just society. Yeah. So that would be, for that person, something that is in excess of the success and status and all the things that we talked about that weren't actually fulfilling. But I wouldn't say that that's necessarily true of someone who's, let's say, of a more mystical persuasion. That person seems to be concerned with what Christians would call unio mystica, or a kind of a direct experience of non-ordinary reality, or what's more ultimately real. And we could begin, at least according to my way of thinking, my form of inquiry here is, could begin to kind of shake out some answers that would be not universal. They'd be somehow kind of well-tuned or well-fitted to the person, but they'd still be general in nature, such as justice or beauty or union or whatever else. That's as far as I've gotten in my thinking on that front, because I speak with people all the time for whom pluralism isn't enough. because they don't seem to have a guide for how they then go about directing their lives, a way to actually navigate it toward what seems to be most fulfilling.
That's right. And this is where I've landed. I believe that as you start to locate the sphere that you feel happiest in, most fulfilled in, if it's justice, mystical, for me, it's the conversations of, you know, in philosophical nature, that's where I find my happiness and fulfillment. But then, you know, you interact with the real world and you navigate the experience back and forth to fine tune what that means for you, because it's the manifestation of that, that, right, is really our only choice. And mm-hmm. what do mm-hmm. I do with this interest? I manifest it into the world. Okay, I can manifest it through this podcast. I can manifest it through writing. I can manifest it through going to graduate school. Mm-hmm. Graduate school? Nope, that didn't really work. the podcast? Okay, this is working. I love this one. So you find the manifestations that seem to bring that thing that you want into the world and keep that level of happiness intact. And then people always push back on me and they say, well, come on, Laura, it can't always be fun. And I don't mean pleasure. I don't mean fun. There's a lot of times I don't like what I'm doing, meaning like to do this podcast, I have to, you know, get the files and get them over to a folder in Dropbox and my editors and blah, 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 blah. There's like something like, you know, 26 columns of steps that I have to go through to get one live. I don't necessarily.
Oh dear.
Yeah, I can't say that.
No, it better be good, because this is, you know, the blood, sweat, and tears has made this possible for us to talk today. I'm just kidding.
Yeah, but you're so right. Like, I don't necessarily say, oh, joy, I can't wait to do that part. But it's the broader question, right? Like, I know that this is what I want to be doing. And so there are pieces that in the manifestation that maybe are tedious or time consuming or aren't moving fast enough, right? Like all these qualities that you wish the external world might cooperate more on. But that's not how to choose, right? Because then you're just coming back to the pleasure points. So that's kind of the...
You made two good points. There's two points that come from what you were saying, quite liked. One is, helps us to clear up a misconception about philosophy or about the good life. And that is that there's some kind of realm of ideas, and then there's some kind of realm of practice or a theory and practice. And then one just... either the two don't have any bearing on one another, or the one becomes a label for the other. No, the metaphor used there was manifestation, or even, if I may, can use a little joke here, incarnation. Right? Our ideas are incarnate. We realize them. They're enfleshed. The philosophy is the enfleshment of our ideas. It's a living out of them in proof.
Yeah. I love that, and right, because otherwise, what is it? It's just within us. I don't know. I don't subscribe to the idea that you just walk around on a mountaintop alone with whatever is inspiring deep within you, right? Mm-hmm. I think it's through the contribution, the sharing of it, right, that brings a lot of the joy.
Yeah. And I think also that what you were saying there in terms of your own view helps me to think that there's also something we could say at a formal level about a good life. Namely, that it seems to have a certain kind of shape or coherence. And so that may be a point that Nietzsche and the French philosopher Foucault may wish to bring out, that the good life actually might have a beautiful shape. So if it's the case that, sure, you have some drudgery to do to get ready for this podcast, you can begin to justify that because it's beginning to kind of give a coherence to a life, mm-hmm. a beautiful shape to it, right? And we can die. When we die, we have a way of kind of saying we had a narrative, right? Our life looked and felt a certain way and had a certain contour that was not just, you know, pleasing to the senses, but was kind of deeply pleasing to our mind's eye,
right? To our deeper truth and to our inner being, our self. It feels that there's some sense of it's one and the same and has a structure. Yeah, I love that. I love that way of bringing in those philosophers and that idea. Andrew, I can't believe this. We've already filled up 40 minutes. This is such a great conversation. I could chat with you all day. I hope everybody out there has enjoyed a sort of deep dive into some of the philosophies that Andrew is bringing into the world. If people want to find out more about you, they want to learn more about your coaching techniques, read about you, where can they find you?
Well, they can find me on my website, which is andrewjtaggart.com, or they can find me on Twitter, which is at andrewjtaggart, or basically they can search for Andrew Taggart Philosopher. And just be clear that it's not the singer in the duo Chainsmokers. So I'm a little bit older, my hair is longer, and I'm not nearly as popular.
Andrew, thank you for coming on. It means a lot to me to chat with you and for you to share your views with all of us.
Well, you're welcome very much. Thank you very much for having me.